Colonel Brett's real foe.
The casualties in this brigade, in our brigade, amounted to 34 killed and 44 wounded, none in my regiment, against which it was later ascertained that the tribesmen lost 94 killed and 64 seriously wounded. For several days afterwards, tribesmen could be seen well out of rifle shot, picking bodies up and transporting them away on camels. Intelligence reports stated that about 1,000 had taken part in the attack, 500 from the intransigent Torikil tribe, with 200 Marsuds, the remainder being Afghans from across the border.
So did the South Wales borderers not get any casualties at all during this campaign?
Yes, we got some casualties later on. Very few, fortunately. One killed, and two or three men, and one officer wounded, in a raid we had made, or rather, an encircling movement we had made some months later from the camp we were then in round to another camp. That was in an action where the tribesmen had attempted to ambush us, and where we had disturbed their ambush. They suffered, we hope, rather more casualties than we had, but it was only a small affair.
And how often did you actually see the enemy?
Well, that is rather hard to say. After that action I had described, when the Gurkhas were so much in it, we did see a lot of them moving about the country with their camels, picking up their dead and other casualties. But after that, I cannot remember seeing any until we were in a camp, Garryong camp, when the local headman used to come in and call on us. Now, he used to come to see the political officer, of course, who was in our camp. Now, he looked just like a Norfolk farmer, with a great red face. He used to he just put him in a Norfolk jacket, and he looked like an English farmer, but he was the headman of his little village. He was the only Pathan we used to see at close quarters. The next time I really saw them close was when peace was coming, and we were handing over our pickets to the tribesmen to take over, and I led one party of tribesmen up to one of our picket posts and handed over to them, withdrawing my own men as soon as the tribesmen had taken over.
How often did you try to set ambushes yourself to capture the enemy?
Well, we didn't often do that, but there was a special regiment called the Tochi Scouts who used to do that kind of thing. They were all tribesmen with a very few British officers, be about one British officer per company. We were particularly interested in them in that one officer who frequently came through our camp was the son of one of our old quartermasters. I'm sorry to say that he was killed later on in another campaign altogether, but still on the frontier. Now, he was practically a tribesman by this time himself, was able to move without being seen, just like the many other tribesmen, and these were the chaps who used to make most of these sudden rushes and sudden attacks on villages which they thought they could take. They never operated in parties of more than a platoon strong, say 30 men, possibly less. And they used to make these very sudden raids upon a village where they hoped there might be somebody who would be of value to the other side.
And what success did they meet with?
They met with a fair amount of success, quite a fair amount of success. They were also the chaps who gathered information and brought it into the political officer, who fed it out to us if it affected the campaign.
Was the Fakir of Ypres ever taken?
No. He got through that campaign without being taken prisoner at all, and it's only a few years ago that I heard of his death.
And how did the troops stand up to the campaign?
Our troops stood up to it extremely well. They were a very fine body of men, really. I've got the utmost belief and admiration for them. We got on extremely well with the Gurkhas in our brigade. I remember once seeing two men, one a Gurkha, the other a Welshman, sitting in a trench with the Welshman showing the Gurkha one of our old magazines and explaining what the pictures all meant, not knowing a word of Gurkhali, and the Gurkhali not knowing a word of Welsh or English. And yet both of them thoroughly enjoying it, laughing at this and laughing at that, and it really was a picture to have seen these two men making thoroughly good friends and getting on like that. Our brigadier, who had been at the Imperial Defence College in London when he was appointed to the command of the brigade, had had the very good sense to visit South Wales to find out something of the atmosphere and environment from which his British battalion had come. He told us afterwards that the Gurkha battalions had said to him how lucky we are to have the Border Pulton with us. Border Pulton was what they called us, Pulton meaning battalion. And in that way, I think we were an asset to the brigade. When there was a question of digging trenches, the Gurkhas used to stand and watch our men and then go away and try and imitate them. Being Welsh miners, most of our men, or sons of Welsh miners, they knew how to dig quickly by scratching at the soil, undercutting it, and letting the top fall in. The Gurkhas thought this was great fun and imitated it as best they could. The Welshmen could naturally dig far faster than anybody else, but the Gurkhas were a very good follow-up. When it came to going up the hills, the Welshmen could climb just as fast as the Gurkhas, climb up, but they could not come down anything like as fast as the Gurkhas. The Gurkhas were really speedy coming down. You'd find a man coming down in great 10-foot strides. Once one of our corporals was rather badly injured when a Gurkha accidentally bumped into him and threw him into some rocks or something of that sort, and we had to carry him back as a casualty. The Gurkha and his regiment came and apologized.
But conditions must have been very tough for the men, were they, on this campaign?
Oh yes, conditions were tough, yes. Our feeding maintained, on the whole, a very good standard. I've described how these convoys were guarded on their way up by our pickets. A convoy would consist of the Indian Army Service Corps bringing up our rations in lorries. Occasionally they would bring up a flock of goats. That is to say, we would call that the ration on the hoof. Well, that was the best way of arriving with fresh meat, but it meant that our cooks had to go in for a certain amount of butchery. There was one particular goat that the cooks refused to kill. He was an extremely friendly animal, and he became a regimental pet. And one would very often see this goat playing with the men. He'd be charging at them, and they'd be receiving the full charge on their heads with their helmets on. It was rather fun to watch them, but you know what soldiers are with animals. And as I say, this particular ration on the hoof became the regimental pet. We kept them for a very long time.
Was this a flock of goats bought from villagers or something?
Yes, this flock of goat must have been bought from a friendly village.
And were the troops less well fed on this campaign than they would have been on the plains? Did they have less variety of food?
Oh no, I wouldn't say there was any loss of good food the whole way through that campaign. After all, one has always known, as Napoleon put it, that an army marches on its stomach. Well, that applies. You feed your men, and they will fight and march and follow you. Don't feed them, starve them, neglect them, and it will call for extremely high morale to get them through. They will only understand it and make good the going if they realize fully why you've been unable to feed them.
Was water supply a problem?
Water supply was, I suppose, a bit of a problem to the people who were supplying us with the water, but we never noticed it, except when it came to washing water, and that only occasionally. Usually it was possible, where our camps were, to dig and find water underneath. And so we got our water that way from natural sources. The camps that we built were always just 7 hours march apart. 7 miles apart, I should say, through rocky, difficult country, because you had to arrive in about midday, otherwise you couldn't get your pickets in and your stores up and build your camp before dark. Now, it was essential that your camp should be completed before dark. Otherwise, you could be attacked from any direction. Now, a camp really consisted of a wall, a stone wall which had to be built or repaired, if it was an old camp, as soon as you possibly could. Now, it had to be built from rocks carried in by your own troops. And they had to be sighted so as to give, as far as possible, a good field of fire, not be too high, so that the small men, short men like Gurkhas and Welshmen, could shoot over it, and yet sufficiently strong to act as a barricade. They must not be too long around, otherwise your troops would have too long an area to defend. One should normally give a short distance, not more than about 50 yards to a company, something like 150 yards to a battalion. The infantry were, of course, on the perimeter, working round it, and your ancillary troops, the guns, the hospital, transport, were in the middle. The smaller you could make your camp and yet fit everybody in, the better. It was naturally very crowded, but you had that guiding rule, the smaller the better. I remember making an awful mess just before the campaign when I was acting as staff captain, whose duty it was to sight these camps. It was fortunately only during an exercise and there was no enemy. I worked on field service regulations, and I discovered afterwards that I had given the troops far too big an area to defend. They couldn't have done it. And thereafter, when I found that, I burnt my field service regulations and worked on common sense. And when we actually had a new camp for which I was responsible during the campaign, it was as small a one as I could envisage.
What did you do to keep the troops from getting bored on this campaign?
Well, during the first half, say up to, from February up to about September probably, there were always rumors of an attack or rumors of our going on attack, and we occasionally had little exercises, especially in the beginning. We had quite a lot of exercises in mountain warfare, learning how to do it. That kept them very interested. Then there were lectures and talks and things, how to preserve their own lives, not only against the enemy, but health purposes and so forth. We worked them pretty hard, in making practice camps and learning how to build these walls, later on in physical training and so forth. And they were very interested in everything, especially when we were actually on service and expecting at any moment to meet the enemy or to be attacked by him one way or another. And it wasn't until we were quite a long time at Garryowen that we began to find boredom. Now, boredom with troops comes out with insubordination, starting off with small things, like being rude to a non-commissioned officer, possibly refusing to do something that had been ordered to do, and in that way, showing that they were fed up with things. Well, we relieved that by keeping them occupied one way or another, and after a bit, our brigadier suggested a most useful thing, and that was to get a concert party going. And we used to give a concert party every Saturday night, working a different program each week, and we gave that for week after week, and the men looked forward to it. I was in this concert party, and I used to have to tell a story to start off with. I'm afraid they were a little bit low at times, but it used to start the party off very cheerfully indeed. And there was a quartermaster sergeant who had very good ideas indeed, and he used to run out the program, do the rehearsals during the week as best we could do them. We used to find our concert party men largely from our bandsmen and from some signalers who were attached to us, and they used to get off some other duties in order to practice and rehearse during the week. Well, I used to find going around the working parties that there'd be someone would spot me from a distance arriving, and by the time I came, the whole party would be singing the song of the great song of the previous weekend in order to greet me. In other ways, we did try to keep their morale going, and I think we succeeded.
Didn't you say
certainly those little acts of insubordination died out at once?
Didn't you say that the Welshmen in your regiment used to go in for that singing their hymns and so on?
Oh, time? Yes. There was one delightful trait of the Welshman, and that is his liability to burst into song, beautifully sung. I remember one night in particular, when the moon was out and the stars were shining, and we were all in our tents, and round about 10 or 11, when we should have been fast asleep, a corporal began to sing. And he was followed by the few voices near him. And then suddenly the entire battalion seemed to get into the song, and they were all at it. And only those who heard Welsh voices can really appreciate how it was that night. And every man in the battalion was singing a hymn and following this corporal as he moved from one to another, not necessarily a hymn, but one of these very well-known Welsh songs. I'm afraid I can't remember the names of them now, but it really was lovely, and one could have listened to them for hours. Little things like that beguiled the time, and we even found the Gurkhas used to inquire about these songs and what they meant.
What did you say to them?
Well, it was translated to them that these men were very fond of singing, and that if the Gurkhas thought they could do better, we should love to have a competition with them. And we did. I'm afraid we didn't like their music or their songs very much, but it encouraged them, and that was always helpful. Where have we got to?
Did you take your bearer with you to the frontier campaign?
Yes. Yes, all officers' bearers accompanied them on the campaign. And they were used, in addition to looking after their own officer, they were used in the officer's mess to assist the mess sergeant and the mess staff in preparing the food, keeping the mess in order, and so forth. They were invaluable in very many ways. One knows that story of Gunga Din and how he died carrying water to the troops. And although he was dying, yet handing out his sack full of water so the troops might drink. Well, that I think was perfectly true of all the Indian servants. They would have died to have done something for their master.
Could I ask you about the training that you did again? Did you have any joint training exercises with the RAF?
Well, with the RAF, no, we did not. They had very few RAF, really. When it came to that campaign, usually we could call upon them for assistance if required, and they could come and fly around and try to find bodies of the enemy. And if there was such a thing as a body of the enemy, they could locate them. They could signal down to the gunners, and the gunners could bombard that bit. They used to carry a few bombs, but not very many. They couldn't. They were fighters and reconnaissance planes rather than bombers, and therefore they couldn't take part in any bombing raid. They did all they could for us, but there were no combined exercises. They knew where we were, they knew what we wanted, and they tried to get the answers.
Did you have any contact with RAF men on the ground whilst you were in India? Did you come across them?
No, I didn't come across any RAF men on the ground, no. One RAF man used to bring us mail, or used to bring one particular officer mail. The flyer happened to be a great friend of the wife of one of our officers, and men, of course, and he used to bring occasionally a parcel and drop it on a small parachute thing into our camp. That would be picked up by someone. It would have an address on it and bring it over to our officer. And that way we managed now and again to get a tin of sweets or something of that sort.
How much contact did you have with the Indian soldiers? How much contact was there between the British regiments and the Indian regiments, apart from on this campaign or on training exercises?
Well, apart from the training, one would have contact with them in sports, games, especially hockey, to a limited extent on football, and certainly in athletics. I suppose some social occasions, not very many, but in that way they would have contacts. But I can't think of any other contacts between them.
Was there a sense of rivalry between the Indian soldier and the British soldier?
Only in the field of games and sports.
So no, there were no instances of conflict or anything like that?
I never heard of any whatsoever. No, shooting exercises, of course, would be very popular with both sides. And you'd be frequently having a rifle match, or a machine gun match, a revolver match, something of that sort, between two regiments, one British and one Indian. Or a local bisley, say, a kind of national rifle meeting when every weapon and every soldier of every type could come into battle, friendly battle.
Did you find that there was very much difference between your attitude to India and Indians as an officer in a British regiment to the attitude of the officers in the Indian regiments?
I can't say, no, I couldn't answer that one really, because I had very little contact with Indian regiments. There was a time when, as a staff captain, acting staff captain to our brigade in Abbottabad, when I was attached to an Indian regiment mess and fed and slept with them. I can't say I noticed any difference at all. Of course, this was in one of these garrison messes where, again, there were very few civilians of either Indian breed or English. And therefore, I couldn't really say how these other chaps met them. Of course, there were Indian commissioned officers with these Indian regiments, and therefore they would be members of the Indian regiment mess, and they would all mix in together.
Was there a difference between those commissions that the Indian officers received and the ones that the British officers received?
I doubt it. No, I think they were all treated the same in an Indian regiment. There were two types of commissions in a way. The Viceroy's Commission, which wasn't thought of quite so highly as the King's Commission. I can't think of any reason why there should be any difference between the two. The men came from the same training. The only difference was that the King's Commissioned officer had been through Sandhurst and the other had not. The other had been through the Indian Military Cadet College, but not through the English Cadet College.
And it was just the Indians who received the Viceroy's Commission, was it?
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me what it was that took you to the frontier, first of all, on that campaign?
Well, I don't think I can do much better than read what I wrote years ago from the same book that I mentioned before. That was, trouble was brewing in Waziristan during the latter part of the year, and the brigade had to stand by at short notice for a fortnight in December before affairs appeared to be settled. The situation worsened again in January, and when a political agent was murdered and a column ambushed with severe casualties in February, the 1st Abbottabad Brigade was ordered up to reinforce the troops in tribal territory. And we moved up on the 23rd of February. The other units in the brigade consisted of the 2nd, 5th Royal Gurkha Rifles and the 1st, 6th and 2nd, 6th Gurkha Rifles, together with the Abbottabad Mountain Artillery Brigade, all under the command of Brigadier Inskip. And that's what brought us up into the frontier for the first time in the history of my regiment.